Talk about the question of how the early universe could have been classical, given that we, you know, think that the fundamental laws are quantum laws. Donc je veux parler de la question pourquoi l'univers tout jeune pouvait déjà être classique, même si on pense que les lois fondamentales sont des lois quantiques. Okay, now it's a Canadian talk. So the hot Big Bang theory has many puzzles that are often talked about. You know, often we talk about the flatness, the horizon puzzle. The biggest one is probably the singularity puzzle. But another puzzle is just the question of why was the early universe already classical, right? This is less often talked about. What is very well understood is sort of the quantum to classical transition of cosmological perturbations. But that's not really what I want to talk about. Here I want to talk more about the classicality of the background itself. Now, this is also at least claimed to be quite well understood via decoherence, right? So the usual explanation goes that it's the perturbations, the interactions between the perturbations and the background that effectively decohere the background. Now, this is certainly a part of the story, but there are reasons not to be completely satisfied with this explanation. One is that decoherence is normally talked about by assuming a classical time, right? Well, the question is rather, how did time actually become classical in the first place? The other thing is that you need this sort of decomposition into background and perturbations, and it's not clear to me whether this would always have been appropriate. So even though this is part of the story, what I want to talk about in this talk is that there's an additional way in which classicality is achieved, which is via just the dynamics of the background itself. And this is already, well, this is discussed in some papers by Hartle and Hawking and Hertog. And what I'm going to talk about also builds on papers that I wrote with Lorenzo Battara, and there will be follow-up work with Sebastian Bramberger and Jane Farnsworth, who was a student here until recently. Now, in quantum mechanics, one interesting way to formulate problems is to use the Feynman's path integral formalism, right, where we just, to calculate a transition between two configurations, we sum over all intermediate paths. Now, one can do a similar extension to quantum gravity, just semi-classical quantum gravity, to calculate transitions between two three-dimensional spatial hypersurfaces by summing over all four-dimensional geometries in between. So we would just define a path integral in this heuristic way. Here, I've written it by using the Euclidean formulation. That doesn't particularly matter for this talk. I will. That's because later on I want to tie it to the no-boundary proposal, but you can equally well think of this as just the ordinary Lorentzian action. Now, and then normally you would calculate transitions between two hypersurfaces in which the fields take some specified values, b and chi, here. So really this transition amplitude should contain both initial and final data, but I will be mostly interested in just the final hypersurface, which is why I've just had these two B and chi here. Now, okay, I should say from the outset, there are many criticisms that you can immediately raise about this approach. You know, why not use string theory or some fundamental theory of quantum gravity? Does this make any sense? The thing is, this can make sense, or should make sense, if the curvatures involved are not too high. So if we don't reach the Planck scale, this should at least give us an indication for what's happening. The other thing is that we know from classical studies, from BKL, that as you approach a singularity, actually, the mini-superspace approximation, which I will use here, gets better and better. So there is some hope that really one can learn something from this approach. Now, let's see. So the action I will use is just gravity and the scalar field. And in fact, it's just mini, yes.
Yeah, like in BKL, it's an space.
That's right, yes.
So you want to use BKL, then you want part of it, but not all of it.
That's right, yes. At the moment, yes. In follow-up work, I will use all of it. But this is still work in progress. I will show you the story without anisotropies now. So here it's just the scale factor of the universe, A, and the scalar field phi with the potential V. Now, an interesting aspect is that if you want to approximate this path integral, if you want to just look at the leading contribution, you can use the saddle point method. And typically what you find is that the configuration which gives the dominant contribution is a complex solution. So even though the boundaries here are real, and have to be real because we want to make contact with actual physics, the configuration in between, the dominant contribution in between, is typically complex. But you should realize this is not the space-time manifold, right? This is just the approximation to the path integral. The space-time itself is encoded in successive such real spatial Heifel surfaces. Okay. And then the question is, once we calculate this, how do we tell whether the universe is classical or quantum? Well, here we can simply use the WKB criterion for classicality. If we have, which you all know from ordinary quantum mechanics, if you have just a potential barrier like this, you know that the wave function on the classical side is just oscillating rapidly while underneath the barrier it is decaying. So if you represent the wave function in the WKB approximation as an exponential, the criterion is simply that the criterion for classicality is simply that the amplitude of this should vary slowly compared to the phase, right? And we can use the same criterion here just to assess whether the universe or the wave function of the universe is classical or not. Note that to do this assessment, we actually need to evaluate this transition amplitude for successive final hypersurfaces. You don't just have one configuration, but you need to do this over a family of configurations. So this final hypersurface will follow a classical solution of the field equations. And for each one of them, you have to calculate the complex instanton solution that leads to it. Well, if you have this family, you can see how the wave function evolves, and you can determine whether it really implies a classical universe or not. And here I will just, since I'm just using the scale factor in scalar field, I will denote the value of the scale factor by little b on this final hypersurface and the value of the scalar field phi by chi. This is to distinguish the values in between in this complex four-dimensional geometry from the boundary conditions at the final hypersurface. Okay, so I will just look at a very simple case. It'll be clear later on why I'm just choosing this simple case, which is to have an exponential potential with a constant factor, root 2 epsilon in front here. Now, in this case, if the potential is positive, as you all know, and turns out to be the equation of state, right? If epsilon is smaller than 1, you get an inflationary solution. If the potential is negative, you have a contracting universe. And if epsilon is bigger than 3, you get an ekparotic solution. Now, the advantage of having this form of the potential is that there's an exact solution of the classical field equations, which is given here, which is that the scale factor behaves like a power law. The scalar field has this logarithmic solution, and the potential goes as 1 over lambda squared. Here, I've used lambda as a parameter along the solution. You can think of this as, classically, this would just be time. Okay, and you just have different ranges. For inflation, lambda goes between 0 and infinity. In the ekparotic case, it's negative and runs from minus infinity towards 0. But these solutions are actually of the exact same form. That's why this is, it's an economic way of treating both inflation and ekparosis together. Now, what we need to know is how the action behaves on this final hypersurface. One part of this is trivial, because we have this asymptotic solution, which I should have said is an attractor solution. So we can just easily find out how the imaginary part of the Euclidean action behaves, or this would be the real part of the real action. And we can just plug in this asymptotic solution, and we find that its dependence on B and chi, so on the scale factor and on the scalar field. What is a little trickier is how to find out how the real part of the Euclidean action behaves, or this would be the imaginary part of the ordinary action, right? Because there's no, you would have to know the full complex geometry. The thing is, there is something which helps in this case, which is that theories that just have an exponential potential actually have a shift symmetry in the scalar field, or a scaling, combined with the scaling symmetry of the metric. Right? So under these transformations, the action above transforms into the action below here. So it's the same action, except there's an overall e to the c delta phi factor. So classically, it gives you the same equations of motion, but there's this additional prefactor for the behavior of the action. Now, one can use this symmetry to see how this solution transforms. And you see, each of these solutions is specified by some integration constant, A0. So in a sense, you can use A0 to label the various solutions, distinguish them from each other. And if you know how this A0 transforms, well, then you know how, in fact, the real part of the Euclidean action transforms. And so one can get the scaling, the asymptotic scaling of the real part of the action in this way, right? Just from this symmetry. That's the reason for using the exact exponential potential. One could, of course, then add corrections, you know, when the equation of state is varying, but this is an easy way to actually to get the behavior of the action. Now, so from this, again, we know how this constant A0 depends on the scale factor and on the scalar field and on the scale factor. So once we have these dependencies, we can calculate how the wave function of the universe changes as we go, as the universe expands or contracts, depending on the situation. Okay, and then there's something interesting which comes out. So we calculate the derivatives with respect to the scalar field and with respect to the scale factor. And in both cases, these WKB conditions scale as b to the epsilon minus 3. B, I remind you, is the value of the scale factor. Epsilon is the equation of state. You can also rewrite this in terms of the number of e folds n, in which case you get this factor here, the exponential of minus epsilon minus 3 over epsilon minus 1 times n. So there's and both conditions scale in the same way. So there's a clear way in which, you know, this is telling you exactly not just whether or not the universe is becoming classical, but also how fast. Right? So, sorry, I should add that, you know, now you can have the situation in which you have for inflation, B is growing, and epsilon is between 0 and 1. And you can see that then, you know, as the universe expands, it quickly becomes classical. In fact, in the slow roll limit, where epsilon is 0, it just goes as 1 over B cubed. So the universe becomes classical. These WKB conditions are satisfied inversely proportionate to the volume that you make. In the ekpyrotic case, B is shrinking, but epsilon must be bigger than 3. So again, you see that the universe is becoming classical as it shrinks. It's interesting to see that these values, these limiting values of epsilon equals 3 and epsilon equals 1, are actually encoded in this formula. So if you take this formula here and you know the number of e-folds is increasing according to the definition that I've used, which is up here, you see this prefactor epsilon minus 3 divided by epsilon minus 1 must be positive. And it is positive precisely when epsilon is smaller than 1 or bigger than 3, which are precisely the conditions for inflation and ekpyrosis. Right, so there's something special about these theories, which is that not only, these are the two mechanisms that we know of which can dynamically flatten the universe, but this shows that these are also the two mechanisms which can dynamically make the wave function of the universe classical. So there's it's an interesting link. Now, one can verify this numerically. So I want to show you how that goes. In order to verify this numerically, you have to impose some initial conditions. And to do that here, I've used the no-boundary state to start off the universe. In this case, you can use the well-known inflationary no-boundary instantons, where the bottom corresponds to half of a four-dimensional sphere, roughly glued onto a de Sitter space. Or you can use ekpyrotic instantons, in which case this bottom part is much bigger and corresponds to a portion of Euclidean flat space. and then the universe becomes classical as it shrinks, which is the green part here. Right? And in both cases, in between, this yellow region indicates some region where the fields are just, where the instanton is purely complex. Okay, so just to remind you, the idea of the no boundary proposal is that we will now calculate these transition amplitudes, but instead of having an initial three-dimensional hypersurface at the bottom, you actually require that the geometries are compact so that you avoid having to impose any initial conditions at all. So the initial condition is in the sense that there is no initial condition. Now, let's see. Right. So this is just the example of having pure de Sitter space. As I just said, you have half of a three-dimensional sphere at the bottom and then half of de Sitter space above. If you plot the field values now in, I should have said this, yeah. So you are now treating time as a complex parameter here. For the bottom part, you know, time is Euclidean. For the top part, time is Lorentzian. So you can, if I plot time, the complex time plane in this way, the horizontal part here is the Euclidean solution, the vertical part is the Lorentzian solution. You can change this contour any way you like, right? This is just one way to represent the instanton, to make this split into exact Euclidean and Lorentzian. As long as there are no singularities in this complex time plane, you can, by Cauchy's theorem, you can deform this any way you like, right? The important part is that at late times, going in the ordinary time direction, the fields must become real. Otherwise, you will not be able to reach a real final hypersurface. Yes.
So if you take a more complex potential, a more complex solution where the modes go outside the horizon and then come back in later, what they do in real multiple solutions, models and predictive solutions classicalize and then declassicalize later on?
No, this is just applies to the very beginning stages. As soon as you make perturbations, decoherence will actually set in, right? And then from then on, it is just classical. My idea here is that this would describe sort of the part before you, I mean, in some sense, before you even start making perturbations. Also, I will show you an example later where if you stop one of the ekparotic phase, for instance, and you go over to a kinetic phase, you actually keep the level of classicality you've reached. You don't declassicalize anymore. But I think really at this point, decoherence will be the main reason for why the universe is classical. Right, so if you look at an actual numerical solution here, on this plot, I've plotted the values. This is a relief plot where dark colors correspond to real field values on the left for the scale factor, on the right for the scalar field. And you see, the no boundary point at the bottom of the instanton is at zero. But at late times, there are these two vertical lines that coincide, right, where the fields become real. So this is the actual solution, not the cartoon version that I had before. Okay, and in the ekparotic case, you can do a similar thing. You just need a different contour, which goes down first. And again, at late times, you get these dark lines, which become vertical and coincide. And again, you get a real universe. Here, you don't; these lines end because in this model, there's actually a crunch. I haven't included a bounce here. And so the evolution ends at some point. Okay, and then you can calculate the WKB conditions along a family of solutions. And in fact, I don't know if you see it, but the red dotted line corresponds to the analytic scaling that I just calculated earlier. And you see this corresponds very precisely. So you reach this asymptotic scaling law extremely fast. Okay, and then the universe, this is for the example for inflation. Here's the case for an ekpyrotic potential, and it's exactly the same thing. You reach this scaling law extremely fast. In this example, the potential turns off here towards the end. This is what I was just saying, that once you reach the kinetic phase, the level of classicality just becomes constant. As I said, in the instanton that I showed, the universe actually went into a crunch, which is, so you wonder, you know, which is just not very useful. You make a universe, you make it classical, and then it crunches. So you can add a bounce to this. One way to do this in an effective field theory sense is to add a ghost condensate to this theory. Now, if you add a ghost condensate, you actually have a bouncing solution here. Time runs from right to left. This is the solution for the scale factor at the bounds. At the bottom is the equation of state, which is ekpyrotic during the contraction phase. During the bounds, it becomes very negative. After the bounds, you have kinetic expansion again. So you can now study whether the wave function of the universe remains classical or not across these bounds. This is the instanton solution itself. The bounce occurs here right at the end. One has to zoom in to see it better. This looks a little sharp, but if you zoom in more, you see that this is completely smooth. This is a completely non-singular bounce. And you can study the WKB conditions again. So during the ekpyrotic contraction phase, coming in from the right here, you again get the scaling law that we had earlier. Then there's the bounce part. And interestingly enough, after the bounce, the universe is just as classical or even more than before. What's also funny is, though, that actually during the bounce phase, there are moments here where the WKB conditions do not hold anymore. Right? It would be interesting to see what consequence this has. At the moment, I don't know. Right? But you see that even though you have this complicated dynamics during the bounce, it actually preserves the classicality that you've reached. So let's just briefly look at this factor again, the scaling of the WKB conditions. One might ask the question, what does this imply? You know, what does this favor? Does this favor large, small e-folds, whatever, a strong inflationary phase or a weak one? It kind of depends on what you hold fixed and what you vary, right? If you ask the question, which type of universe becomes classical the fastest for a fixed number of e-folds, then you would prefer to have a strong ekpyrotic phase, so with a very fast-rolling scalar field. But actually, surprisingly enough, a very weak inflationary phase, where epsilon is very close to 1. However, that might not be the right way to think about it, because in such a case, it's hard to get a large number of e-folds. So you might also ask the question, if I have a fixed amount of expansion or contraction of the scale factor, what do I prefer? In this case, both a very slowly rolling inflationary phase or a very fast rolling ekpyrotic phases are preferred. Okay, which is perhaps more in agreement with the intuition in this case. Right, so just to repeat the point that I said earlier, if we the flatness of the universe is achieved if the universe is expanding and epsilon is smaller than 1, or if it is contracting and epsilon is greater than 3. And these same conditions are obtained in order to get classicality of the wave function. So this factor, again, has this epsilon minus 3 of epsilon minus 1 is positive when epsilon is smaller than 1 or bigger than 3. So there just seems to be this link, in some sense, between the two mechanisms that we know that can make the universe flat and the two mechanisms that are known now to make the universe classical via its intrinsic dynamics. There are many ways in which one can now extend this work. I think one interesting question is just to see if there can be any other ways to make the wave function classical. Right? This is not so clear, and hasn't been, surprisingly enough, hasn't been studied at all. Also, one may ask, you know, there is a phase here, when you go to very early times in quotation marks, where the wave function is not classical yet, and where you don't expect decoherence to have occurred yet. At that point, there could be interferences between different branches of the wave function. Right? It would be interesting to see if that could have any effects. The other thing is what happens when anisotropies are included. So I've used mini superspace, but in the very simplest case of just having an isotropic universe. Now, we're currently working on this to do this with anisotropies being included, so I will only be able to tell you about that next time. And then one big question that remains in this field, as in, you know, in general in early universe cosmology, is what is the correct initial quantum state to use? So I've given the example of the no boundary state, but, well, there haven't been many alternatives that have been explored so far. So I think this is something where, you know, real progress can still be made. Thank you.
We have a lot of time for questions. Any questions?
Hi, Jean-Luc.
Hi, Neil.
So question, you don't seem to have spelled out the meaning of this wave function of the universe. And that is far from clear, right? So it's something you can calculate, use semi-classically. You have in mind a path integral with some sort of definition in terms of continuation in Euclidean time and insisting it is smooth, right?
Well, but in fact, I'm just calculating saddle points of the path integral.
Okay, so all you're doing is finding complex classical solutions.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, that's in the entirety. And yes. That's good. That's good for lots of purposes. You can even do the perturbations that way.
Right.
However, what does the wave function mean?
Yeah, you mean...
How do you assign probabilities to it?
And...
Right, so this is unknown.
Yes.
And as far as I can tell, none of the existing proposals make much sense. You know, Hartle and Hawking will tell you it's psi squared.
Yes.
But the problem is psi...
The trouble is it's not normalizable.
It's not normalizable. It's... That's the least of the trouble. Okay. The norm isn't... It's not normalizable, and nor is there any reason for probability to be conserved. It's not unitary. There's no reason.
Well, once you have a classical solution, it does become conserved. It does.
Psi squared?
Yes.
Well, only at very leading order in H bar.
Well, this is only at leading order in H bar. The calculation only proceeds at leading order
in
H bar.
Yeah, but as soon as you go beyond that, it's not going to be conserved. So. It doesn't seem the probabilities are very sensible beyond very leading order.
That's true, but I think the whole framework, in a sense, is just works at leading order in H bar.
Okay.
I would see this as some approximation scheme.
Okay. But we don't know the rules of the game beyond this approximation scheme.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
All right.
So I agree that on that level it is slightly dubious.
It just makes it more interesting.
But it points you towards the questions you can answer, and it points you towards the questions that, you know, where you run up against the problem and that you know you need to think about more. You know, the funny thing is that even though we have proposed theories of quantum gravity, they don't typically address these questions. And if you think that if these theories are correct, at some point there should be some link with such a simple approach. Right. And that's also interesting.
Did I see another question over? I see someone raise their hand. Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure whether it is completely correct, but with the non-boundary proposal, as I understand it, have often both a superposition of an expanding and a contracting universe at the same time. And what in that situation would, the universe being classical mean?
So the no boundary wave function contains both expanding and contracting solutions, that's right. But this would... you know, this classic, as classicality is reached, these different branches start to become more and more separate, right? And start behaving independently. So I would say it's not completely clear what the meaning of the contracting ones is. Currently, they're only, you know, this is in mini superspace, so it doesn't make much. You can take, you know, the time reversed one is simply the, well, just the time reversed version of the expanding one. Once you start including fluctuations, it will change a lot, because the expanding inflationary one or the contracting ekparotic one are attractors, while their time reversed counterparts are not. So I think that will distinguish them then.
Thank you.
Could you describe to me what it means for the universe to be 10% classical? So for example, I mean, just going back to the simple one-dimensional quantum mechanics example, you know, what does that tell us when the ratio of the amplitude to the phase is, you know, 10%? Can you just tell me concretely what that means for measurements of the position of the particle or something like that?
Yeah, of course I cannot. It's the short answer. I mean, this is not... it's somehow not the right way to say it. I mean, you're kind of asking what happens as you follow as you follow a classical solution of the field equations, what happens to the wave function of the universe? And you kind of ask, to what extent can I, from this, reconstruct a classical space-time? And then this number would sort of give you an indication to what extent you can do that. once you start adding another, if you want to measure something in addition in this, you have to repeat the calculation for sets of final states which include these measurements, and then see what happens, see what you get. Right? So, okay, I'm not 100% sure, but it may be that you're thinking about this instanton solution as somehow. You know, this is not the actual universe. You kind of recreate the space-time by looking at how the wave function behaves. And then you can only do this, in a classical way once these WKB conditions become very small. Of course, you can ask how small do they need to become, and that's, you know. So in that sense, I don't know if 10% is good enough or not. The thing is that these numbers become very small, very fast, exponentially small, very fast. Right? That's maybe the interesting part. That only after a couple of e-folds, you've already made these numbers extremely small.
Okay. If that's it, then we have coffee for 15 minutes, or. I guess longer, yeah. So, well, although now, do we try to go back on the earlier schedule or get? Okay. So we'll meet back here at 4:25, so 25 minutes for coffee.